All right, we are finishing up the text of Genesis 50 this evening. Next Wednesday, I will be in Sanford, North Carolina, and Jonathan will be teaching. And I've let him know if he wants to do a kind of a review summary of just the book of Genesis, just kind of a look back at what we've covered over the last year and a half. He's welcome to do that, or he can do something else. Or if he wants to, he can do the first chapter of Daniel. I let him know those are the options. Anything he wants to do, and two options in addition. But the week after that, the next Wednesday, we'll be starting the book of Daniel and our study of that. I think our primary book, if you would like some additional study material for the book of Daniel as we study it, I think our primary book that we'll be using will be Jim McGuigan's commentary on Daniel. That can be found on Amazon. I know you can get it in digital formats. I'm not sure how easily accessible it is or if it's still in print to be able to be gotten in print formats. But if you need help getting a hold of that and would like to get a hold of it, let me know and I'll see what I can do. Even if it's contact Jim McGuigan and say, hey, you know somewhere we can get a hold of this, since I've talked with him before. All right, Genesis chapter 50. Let me close this door. No, I thought maybe the cool air would stay in here a little better where they're closed. Genesis 49, we finished up Jacob's statements, his blessings to his children concerning what was to come. Now, we had a question in chapter 49, in that set of questions. And what is the first description of Joseph's blessing and what does it mean? And that would be from verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough. Am I getting that right? I was corrected on that one. Fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. And the simply the idea is connected partially to the idea that he's going to receive a double portion. But it's just this concept of kind of like Psalms chapter 1 uses, the tree planted by the rivers of water. It has its strength because it has this constant source of nourishment. And so Ephraim and Manasseh, the tribes of Joseph, or from Joseph, would be that idea of they would be strong tribes. They would be fruitful tribes in that which they have done, as Joseph has been fruitful. And one commentator pointed out that the first section of Joseph's blessing is, in the Hebrew, it is in past tense. And then the latter portions are in the future tense in Hebrew, though it's not always as obvious, at least in my reading in the New King James, of the New King James or the English translation, but indicating the life of Joseph had something to do with the blessing itself, as well as the future of the tribes of Joseph through Ephraim and Manasseh. So, we come to chapter 50. We read, then Joseph fell on his face, or on his father's face, and wept over him and kissed him. So, verse 33, Jacob finishes his commands to his sons. He draws his feet up in his bed. He breathes his last, and he was gathered to his people. A figurative statement for him dying. All right. So Joseph will come, and he will weep over his father. He will kiss his father's body. And verse 2, Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed, and the Egyptians mourned him 70 days. The idea seems to be that the 70 days included the 40 days of embalming, and then an additional 30 days beyond that. Now, why is it that the Egyptians would have mourned Joseph or mourned Jacob's death? Okay. I think the reason for the mourning is, as Dan mentioned, it's because Joseph's mourning and their connection to Joseph. I mean, this is the real sense. This is the savior of their whole land. They'd all be dead without Joseph. Had it not been for his interpreting the dream, had it not been for his control in the previous years in providing food and their constant necessity to come to him for food, without him, they're dead prior to this. And so I think you see the connection that they have to Joseph, the love, the admiration, and the adoration that they have of this individual who's second in command in Egypt. And when his father dies, their outpouring of grief is a connection to their respect for him. And I think that is the connection there in that. And also there is to some extent the difference in the way many ancient civilizations considered mourning over a death as opposed to the way we do in modern society, in most, at least Western civilizations. We go have a funeral, and then we spend a day or two with the family, and then we go on about our business and our lives. And such was simply not the case. That was not the way they handled the death of a loved one or something along that lines in this former time period. So that probably has something to do with it as well. But all of that being said, the Egyptians will mourn for Jacob, Joseph's father. Verse 4. Now when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh," saying, and then he'll give the message he wants them to speak to Pharaoh. Let me catch up on the questions on the sheet itself. What question number one, what did Joseph command his servants to do to Jacob's body? Embalm. All right. Number two, text we're in right now. Why did Joseph ask Pharaoh to allow him to take Jacob's body back to Canaan for burial?
Because that's what Israel wanted.
All right. All right. Jacob made him swear that they would bury him in the grave or in the cave in Machpelah where Abraham, Isaac, and their wives and Leah were buried. But in verse 4, he goes to Pharaoh's household, those individuals within the court of Pharaoh, and he goes to them and asks them to go before Pharaoh. Why? What are some ideas as to why that might be? Okay. All right, maybe respect. Though, of course, when you consider it, as second in Egypt, he had a higher position than they did, but maybe the closeness to Pharaoh as being part of his household.
Well, that was going to be my thought. Maybe Joseph isn't as close to Pharaoh as what we might think, even though he is second in command, because Pharaoh basically just said, you're in control, except I'm still the only one above you.
Okay. The only thing I would say concerning that is Joseph describes himself as a father to Pharaoh in prior chapters, which indicates a very, very close connection beyond just the fact that Joseph serves as second in command. Go ahead.
Is this maybe a different Pharaoh? Or do we not have any indication that it's a different Pharaoh?
We don't have any indication one way or another, so the assumption would probably be that it's not. Might it not be, as some commentators have suggested, that Joseph is still going through the mourning process? And in a civilization such as that, you would not, still being in the grieving process, you would not appear before the king because of his position in that status of mourning. that would have been a breach in protocol in many civilizations in ancient times to appear before the king in a state of mourning.
But it says the days of Joseph's mourning were
past. It says when the days of his mourning, and that being the Egyptians' mourning for him, the pronouns that would be his, Jacob. And so it's not necessarily the idea that the days of the Egyptians mourning him, but that doesn't mean that necessarily Joseph has ceased that mourning process, but the Egyptians have. So that could be an indication that the official days of mourning set aside for Jacob by the Egyptians had passed, and now it's time to go. So the text doesn't explicitly state one way or another why Joseph used the household, but he does. So for some reason, instead of Joseph coming immediately before Pharaoh, he will utilize the household of Pharaoh. He will go to them and say, go to Pharaoh for me. And what is clear from the text is Joseph is in a position, not only in a position in the society, but also as the person whom he is, in the eyes of them, that this was no problem. And we're going to see Pharaoh's reaction is no problem there either. And so notice what we have. Verse 5, my father made me swear, this is the message that the household is going to deliver to Pharaoh. My father made me swear, saying, behold, I am dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. There you shall bury me. Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back. So Joseph makes it clear. I want permission to go and bury my father, but I will return. I'm not leaving. The Israelites aren't going to leave permanently. We're going to bury Jacob, bury Israel, and we're coming back. And he seeks permission for this to occur. Now, quick question. When you step over to the book of Exodus and Moses and Aaron come before Pharaoh, what do they initially ask for in regards to the people of Israel? Do they initially ask for the ability to leave Egypt permanently?
No, let's go just to hold a peace in the wilderness.
Okay. They request the opportunity to leave Egypt to go and worship their God in accordance with what he has prescribed. And Pharaoh will not even allow them to do that, even with the expectation and the requirement that they return. He says no.
But it's a different Pharaoh.
Granted, I understand that. I'm looking at the difference between the attitudes of these two Pharaohs. Here, the Pharaoh who doesn't know Joseph, the Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, as the text states, he's not going to let the Israelites even go to worship their God and then return. Yet Pharaoh, who knows Joseph, allows his second in command, and we're going to see a great many more than that, to go to bury Jacob and then return. So, this is his request. Pharaoh's answer, go up and bury your father as he made you swear. Simple confirmation, do as you have been sworn that you will do. Now, one thing I did want to point out in, at least as it reads in the New King James, verse 5, when he's quoting Jacob, he says, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I am dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. Does anybody have a different reading than that in their translation that would indicate someone else doing the digging? In verse 5, where he's quoting Jacob's statement, behold, I am dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me. I just bring that up because you step back to when the cave of Machpelah was bought, when Sarah dies, and the indication is Abraham's the one who buries Sarah there. Why is it, or why might it be, that Jacob is describing it as him having dug the grave for himself? what are some possibilities in the thinking about how the ancients would bury their dead? So they're buried in a cave. We recognize that already. So it's already in a, underground. What might they have done where Jacob would have been required to have dug his own grave?
Didn't they make little chambers? I mean, just based on what you see on the History Channel, you know, they had their own little chambers within that cave.
So. Correct. Especially when you look at the Egyptians, and they're a really good model for what would have occurred. You look at the tombs of the pharaohs and such, and what you find when you explore those tombs of the pharaohs is that each pharaoh, even if there were multiple pharaohs in the same structure, the same tomb, they had their own section. They had their own rooms where they were buried, and there was no one else buried there. And so it seems as though that may have been what Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did within the cave of Machpelah. Is once you, if you were walking into the cave, there could be that there was a section that Abraham dug out where he buried Sarah, and then he was buried as well, and a room, as it were, where Isaac was buried and Rebekah was buried, and then a room where Jacob had buried Leah and prepared a place for himself as well. So that could be the answer as to why the statement, the tomb or the grave that I dug, he had prepared his burial place within the cave of Machpelah before he left the land of Canaan. Any thoughts, Grady?
I was thinking he dug it himself. Ground where the family would be buried.
Okay.
They were prepared. He prepared, and knowing he
buried
there too.
Right. He prepared it in advance, knowing that eventuality was going to be the case. So we come down to verse 7. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's house. Only their little ones, their flocks, and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. So, who went up with Joseph to bury Jacob besides his own family? Question number 3. Okay, and then horsemen and chariots. So, for one, this was quite the entourage. For another, very little chance that as we're traveling the roads heading from Egypt to Canaan that they're going to get attacked. Not with the chariots of Egypt and the horsemen of Egypt going with them. All right, there's not going to be a great possibility of danger on this travel. But isn't it significant that, and again, you're seeing the perspective of Egypt looking at Joseph. It's not just some guy going to get buried. This Joseph must have been so well beloved in Egypt that the elders of the whole nation of Egypt drop what they have to go with Joseph to bury his father. Think back again to that statement that Joseph would be the fruitful bough, the tree planted by the river's water, and just how God had blessed Joseph in Egypt, having begun his existence there as a slave.
Do we have any indications to how long this trip would have taken?
No, but it would have been, at a minimum, it would have been weeks, possibly months, to make the travel there, go through all of the things that would have been involved, as well as, I mean, taking the number of people that they took. You could do some looking and kind of measure out the actual distance, and it would give you some better idea. But it's not going to be, 2 days out and 2 days back. type thing.
Just out of curiosity, because it says that the servants of Pharaoh went, was that more for help for Joseph because he was in command, or would that possibly have been a means to make sure that he did return?
There doesn't seem to be any indication that Pharaoh had any doubts that Joseph was going to return, so it probably would have been for the providing of help in the traveling there and back as to the reason why the servants of Pharaoh would have gone. All right, so we come down to verse 10. Then they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there a great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, "This is a deep mourning of the Egyptians." Therefore, its name was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. Now, Abel Mizraim simply means literally mourning of Egypt. So the name of the place itself comes from, at least the name that would have been given to it, comes from the actions that were taken there. It seems as though, from somewhat of the Canaanites' perspective, this great entourage of Egyptians, because that's how they would have appeared. Even though a large portion of them may have been Israelites, there's still enough Egyptians, and here's this individual recognized as this great leader in Egypt coming into the land of Canaan, and they're there and they're mourning, and so it's perceived as this is the Egyptians coming and mourning and doing this there within the land of Canaan. So the inhabitants of the land saw it and they recognized that, and the place will become known as Abel Mizraim. Verse 12, so his sons did for him just as he had commanded them, for his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave which of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who went up with him to bury his father. All right, next question doesn't come until verse 15. So, they buried Jacob. Jacob's life's over. And, you know, as we've noticed with Moses' writings, throughout the book of Genesis, his main structure is follow one specific person and their account, and then kill them off. Even though he may not be dead yet chronologically, kill him off within the account, move on to the next person. You've got Abraham, and then you've got Isaac, and even though Abraham's still alive into the discussion of Isaac, as far as Moses is concerned, kill him off, move on with the next individual who's the focus. Jacob's the one who's going to last the longest into into a parallel with Joseph, though the focus remains consistently on Joseph. But that's simply because of the continuing interactions that are important to the account that is going to be given here by Moses. So we come to verse 15. Jacob's dead. Jacob's buried. They're back in Egypt. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him." Notice a couple of phrases in this verse that I want to key in on. First, evil that we did to him. Are they trying in any way to minimize the reality of what they did? No. They're recognizing the sin they committed and stating it as such. They're not attempting to deceive themselves or anybody else about the reality of what they did. But here's what is also interesting is that you see in them this failed trust in Joseph's actual forgiveness. How long had they been, by this point, how long have they been living in Egypt? Remember? 17 years. Based upon the age Jacob is when he comes into land, 130, and his death being at 147, they had been living in the land with Joseph for 17 years. But now that Jacob's died, their thought is, maybe he's going to take his retribution now. Dad's gone.
Well, when your intentions in your heart as evil as your brothers have been, that is what you focus on.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't even had anything to do with Joseph and how good it was. The idea of trying to be good in the eyes of Dad. First they thought it was being good in order to see Dad again.
Mm-hmm.
And then to stay got Dad's favor. Mm-hmm. You know, so now Dad's gone, you don't have to pretend anymore.
And that's the way some people think. That's the mentality that some people have is, if someone's doing good or being good to them, they're only doing it for their ulterior motives that they may have, whatever those are. And that seems to be somewhat of the perception of Joseph's brothers, that he's only holding out until Jacob's gone, so that Jacob doesn't see what he's going to do to us in return. Eddie, do you have something?
Does to us when we carry guilt for so many years over something. Because consider how long it was before they saw Joseph again, and we know they were carrying that guilt with them from the time they lied to the dad to the time that they finally figured out who Joseph was in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And guilt doesn't just drop like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it takes a lot of prayer and patience and remembering that God and whoever has truly forgiven you to get over that guilt. Some people struggle with the guilt for the rest of their lives, and it may also be that they were dealing with the guilt that they had for so long.
Okay. Now,
were they worried about it might be retaliating?
I think so. I think that's exactly what they were worried about, is that he might retaliate and bring some form of destruction on them. You know, some people do this with God's forgiveness. They do what the Bible prescribes for them to do in order to be forgiven, and they do it with an honest heart, and they do it right. But you see some people, because of their guilt in their own mind for that which they have done, they begin to doubt God's forgiveness. They begin to doubt later on, could he really have forgiven me for that? But what is it that the New Testament describes God as doing when he forgives our sins? He remembers them no more. The accountability for those sins by way of God's judgment is gone. Okay, so as we look at this, Joseph has assured them, seemingly repeatedly, through his actions, that he is not holding them accountable by way of vengeance or retribution for that which they did, because he sees what God used it for. They're not there yet. So they say, perhaps, and that's the other statement I want to key in on this. How many times do we, or do we see others, judge someone's motives by their own bias? This person's going to do this or did this, not because of, and we're not thinking they did it for the wrong reasons because of anything they did. Not because of anything they said. Not because of the attitude and how they did it, but because I can't get past myself, therefore I'm going to think they did it the wrong way or for the wrong reasons. And that's exactly what his brothers did. They attribute their own guilt in their minds, and they push it onto his actions and his motives, and believe that he's going to do that which he's given absolutely no indication whatsoever that he would do. They're firmly convinced this is a possibility. But they have no evidence for it. It's not based upon testimony. It's not based upon action. It's not based upon attitude. It's solely based upon their own bias. And we do that sometimes. And we cause problems with others that don't even exist because of our own bias about ourselves and not them.
The thing with us today and all throughout society is that we're continuing to live in the past.
Mm-hmm.
We will turn loose the past. And that's the biggest failure of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens with this family.
All right. Good point.
I know I deal with what people like to call, you know, my Yankeeisms from where I was upbringing in the North. And if there's one thing I really struggle with, is the ability to forgive and forget. Because that ain't the way I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth is Old Testament, but it's the way it is where I come from. And it's a constant battle to reprogram. 25 years I lived in the North, and I've been down here 13, so I'm halfway there in my mind. But I struggle with that.
Yeah.
I don't want to say I'm judgmental, but I'm very defensive and I don't trust people right off the hop because I don't know what they're up to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's what totally contrary to what the Bible says.
Right.
So it's always been a struggle for me to trust others because
mm-hmm.
I wasn't raised that way. It wasn't that mindset. So
yeah.
It's a dilemma. It's a daily dilemma.
Well, I think people they often do things for you, but make you feel obligated.
Yeah, to do things in return.
Yeah.
Okay, so first or second? First, okay. Right.
Well, I think, too, that's how Satan wants it, because especially in the church, for people who have been offended, Satan wants us to have division among us, because then that means we don't have unity all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd rather have people at odds against each other, because then we're doing the work for him.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And also the guilt sometimes, because the human mind cannot physically make themselves forget the way God does. I think that thing causes people sometimes to sin even more, trying to fix their guilt,
mm-hmm.
trying to hide their guilt.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good thoughts. So he says, or they say, perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil we did to him. So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, before your father died, he commanded, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. So they come to him with, Jacob said, please forgive them. Now, please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. You've got to imagine, Joseph has gone through this process of 17 years thinking, it's done. Remember, he named one of his children, God's finally made it possible for me to forget my home, my family. And now his family's come back into his life, and 17 years later, it's done, it's over with, it's forgotten, we're past all of that. Here we are again. Really, that's where it is. He's moved on, he's past it, he's forgiven them, and it's why haven't they let go of this, seems to be his reaction, and weeping, because he still sees, they think I'm still holding this against them when this was God on our behalf. Eddie?
It would be interesting to know if the brothers approached their dad and said, we think Joseph is not going to forgive us, or if Jacob himself wanted to make sure because he knew his own sons well enough to know that they would do this. Do you know what I mean? It would
right.
be interesting to know
Or if they're dredging up a statement from Joseph or Jacob from 17 years ago, saying, when I'm gone, do this.
Because with Jacob and how he treats Ephraim and Manasseh as giving Joseph the double portion and things like that, you don't see an indication that Jacob is worried about Joseph's forgiveness.
Absolutely. Alright, so Joseph weeps when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, "Behold, we are your servants." So they go, send messengers. Here's the message that arrives, and now they follow it with this procession of, "We're your servants." Verse 19, Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God?" That passage should remind you directly of Romans chapter 12, beginning in verse 17, 18, through the end of the chapter, about not bringing forth retribution. "Vengeance is mine," says the Lord. Am I in the place of God? Am I judge of all the earth? Is it my responsibility to bring about vengeance upon you for something you did to me in the past? It's a rhetorical question, folks. And none of us is, but sometimes we act like it. I'm not going to be satisfied till I get this settled. I've got my score settled with whoever did me wrong. Joseph, 17 years later, he's forgiven them and he thinks this is over with. Am I in the place of God? "But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive." And many people is not just his family. All Egypt was saved and more as a result of what they did. "Now, therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, and he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw Ephraim's two children to the third generation. The children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. So he saw Ephraim's what? Indication is great-grandchildren. Son, grandson, great-grandson is who he would have seen at least be born within Egypt. And Joseph said to his brethren, "I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here." So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Now, really quick points before we close. Number one, his statement, "I am dying, but God will surely visit you." Joseph lived most likely 93 years out of his 110 years in Egypt. Among pagans, among those who did not primarily worship God, and yet at the end of his life, he's as devoted to God as he was the day he walked in. He's an example of faithfulness. He's an example of constant dedication to God, and everybody knows it.
And imagine what would have happened if all the Israelites, when they went back to Canaan, would have remembered that.
But notice also,
is that word, do good over people?
Absolutely. There with what Joseph does with his brothers. Alright? But in addition to that, Joseph dies. And you can see his perspective is Israel doesn't belong in Egypt. I mean, yes, they're in the best land in all of Egypt. They're in Goshen. He's been second in all of Egypt for all of this time they've been there. But his mind is still, Israel doesn't belong here. He reassures them of the covenant that didn't die with Jacob, continues on to them. Don't make your home here. You're sojourners. God will bring you back to Canaan that he's promised you. This world's not your home. Just passing through. But then also, he says, or he takes an oath from them, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here." You read in the book of Joshua, where after the wars are finished, fighting is done, They've taken the land to the extent that they will during that time period. They then, having brought Joseph's coffin from Egypt, they buried Joseph as he made them swear. And so during all of the time that they're in wandering in the wilderness, all of the time that they're slaves in Egypt, all of the time that they're fighting the wars and taking the land, Joseph's coffin's with them. But Joseph's coffin will be a reminder to them while they're in Egypt. When they see it, they will be reminded, here's a man who achieved second of, in power in all of Egypt, but he still died. He's still mortal. You can gain the whole world, you're still going to die. It will be a reminder to them as a sign of hope that God will visit you. And if they have been reminded of that hope more, if they had remembered that promise of Joseph, they'd have been had a slightly different attitude when he came back. Or when Moses came and or God came back to get them and God visited them. Notice also it was a reminder that in the land of Egypt, it was a solemn reminder in the land of Egypt of every Israelite that Egypt was not their home. And also it was a reminder of the patience of faith. Think about the years in Egypt and then the 40 years lugging his coffin through the wilderness. Regardless of the trials and difficulties in this life, our faith should be patient based upon the promises of God. And fifth, it was a pledge of their possession. God will visit you and the land will be yours. It was based on faithfulness, though. Their faithfulness was required for God to deliver the promise, which is why the first generation won't get it. Because of their unfaithfulness, the next generation will take his coffin into Canaan. It should have been a reminder to them, if you're faithful, God will provide. You're dismissed.